Good morning. I'm Fran Michelle, and I'm talking with Munira Lokhandwala, Director of Technology and Training with the Public Accountability Initiative, also known as Little Sis, which is one of the creators of a project and website exposing the genocide gentry, the executives and board members of major weapons companies who also hold positions at academic and cultural institutions, making decisions about how to respond to the genocide in Gaza. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can you tell us, what is the Genocide Gentry Project and how did it come about?
Yeah, so the research was conducted jointly between ourselves, Little Sis, Adala Justice Project, and the Action Center on Race and the Economy. And it draws out the connections, as you said, between executives and board members at six major weapons companies. So Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, and Raytheon, as well as Elbit Systems of America. And we, you know, started simply by looking at the people who sit on the boards of these companies and starting to map out their connections to other institutions, right? So we looked at their business, we looked at other business positions that they had. But I think the thing that was most striking to us was how many connections we found just looking at these six companies to museums, cultural institutions, universities, and colleges. And, you know, we were interested in what felt like contradiction, right? To have people who are profiting from and benefiting from the sale of arms and weapons being hosted by these institutions of culture and humanities. And so we really wanted to kind of highlight this sort of contradiction and ask, why is it that these, you know, institutions of the humanities are giving prominent positions to people who profit from war and genocide? And so that was sort of how the research shaped the project. And I think in a broader way, we were seeing especially after the spring of 2024, the level of repression that was happening on college and university campuses, the silence from, you know, museums and art and culture institutions around the genocide, and, you know, wondering how it could be that as we're seeing Israel destroying every university in Gaza and nearly 200 cultural heritage sites since, you know, October 2023, how is it that these sister institutions in a way in the US are choosing to remain silent or even worse, repress any kind of protests around Palestine and ceasefire? And so that's a little bit of kind of what animated us deciding to kind of like look into these ties.
I know that here in Portland, organizers have targeted financial ties with some of these weapons corporations. For instance, Portland State University activists demanded the university cut ties with Boeing. Can you talk about how the sort of power mapping of people's relationships mm-hmm. add to that work? If there isn't the explicit connection of Boeing is giving money to the university, what are we getting by seeing the individuals who are overlapping in these groups?
We're seeing in some ways, I think the research around the financial ties is very, very important. And it's been really powerful to see students, activists on college campuses sort of take that on and make demands around cutting these financial ties. And I think it's really important for us as organizers and as people kind of invested in this work to also understand the other ways that corrosive industries like defense and the fossil fuel industry are so deeply embedded within our institutions, right? That our colleges and universities are inviting people who are, you know, profiting from and enabling, you know, such destruction to happen, to then to invite them to come make decisions about how the university is run, is really problematic and something that we should really be asking why. What kind of expertise are these people bringing to our institutions?
One of the things that the genocide gentry research turns up is that there's a lot of overlap between weapons manufacturers, cultural organizations, and also fossil fuel. organizations and corporations. What do we make of that, the fossil fuel military intersection there?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the industries are very much reliant on one another, right? They, pun intended, they fuel one another in various ways. And so, as you mentioned, many board members of weapons companies do have significant ties to not just fossil fuels, but also kind of neoliberal institutions and different kinds of extractive industries, think tanks and philanthropy. And this kind of network is really important because it is a network. It is, you know, a group of, and networks are groups of individuals, right, who are kind of building power through their shared connections. And so we do make particular note in this data set of individuals who hold ties to fossil fuel companies as a way to highlight that Palestinian liberation and climate justice are actually linked struggles, often having a shared kind of common corporation that is fueling the ongoing genocide in Gaza, you know, as well as kind of ecological destruction and climate crisis. And so that felt like an important thing to include because it's hard to ignore that connection is there, you know.
Case studies on the site, examples include not only universities, but also places like the Kennedy Center and groups like the Human Rights Campaign, which has some major corporate donors, including Northrop Grumman. Are there overlapping board members as well for something like the Human Rights Campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the list of corporate sponsors for the HRC, you see companies, corporations who are responsible for all kinds of, whether it be anti-worker or companies that are providing surveillance equipment or, you know, militarizing our police. And then, you know, the most egregious example are these defense companies that get to have their names and brands celebrated by an institution like the HRC simply by cutting a check, right? And again, that check, that money that they donate to the HRC is made off of the killing of people around the world, right? Including Palestinians in this moment. And so we really need to hold these institutions accountable for what it is they uplift, what it is they're sort of whitewashing by inviting, allowing these corporations to sort of make these kinds of donations, taking their money and then, you know, allowing them to sort of be celebrated at their galas and at their events. So, you know, while, you know, there aren't maybe multiple board members from these industries, we do see like many, again, really kind of corrosive industries, destructive industries that are welcome by these institutions.
So we're looking then at both the financial ties that often go along with these relationships, but also the more indirect kinds of policy pressures that individuals involved in these cultural institutions or academic institutions can be bringing to bear,
absolutely,
even without those explicit financial ties.
Right. I mean, we see that, you know, our higher ed institutions, our cultural institutions feel really vulnerable to the pressures of the sort of political landscape, right? And so one strategy, you know, for them has been to fundraise through bringing people like CEOs of weapons companies onto their boards. It, you know, it ensures a certain kind of potentially having access to different kinds of resources, but it comes at a cost, right? When you make decisions kind of based on, you know, having access to people who can fundraise for you or bring in large donations, you're doing that often at the cost of your own mission and at the cost of the public that you're serving. And so we're really seeing a real disconnect between these cultural institutions, who their public is, what their mission is, and who they're allowing to guide the decision-making around how that institution is going to publicly engage with the genocide.
The site genocidegentry.org offers information about the people, the institutions, case studies, an organizing guide with examples. There's a map. The map of examples and case studies doesn't have any entries for Oregon, but the site notes that it can provide examples of the kind of research that people can do. What sort of things might people be looking into locally to pursue the kinds of research that you've given examples of here with Genocide Gentry?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, as you said, you know, it's by no means a comprehensive look at the war industry or the culture industry, but it's a starting point for us to think about how to continue to put pressure on the institutions that we are engaged with locally. I think for the first many months of the genocide, there was a lot of emphasis on kind of trying to pressure weapons companies, trying to pressure policymakers, decision makers to, you know, call for a ceasefire. And now, you know, almost a year into this genocide, we're realizing that, you know, people, we need to continue to mobilize and put pressure. And actually, the best thing we can do is mobilize locally and put pressure on our institutions locally to make commitments not to take money from weapons companies, to create kind of standards for how they, and ideally, you know, make statements in solidarity with the people of Gaza. And so I think this research is meant to help open up the view into how the points of pressure don't just exist in DC or in the places, you know, where these weapons companies are headquartered, but that they have a much wider reach, and seeing where that reach lands in our kind of local context is a helpful kind of starting point for organizing and for finding ways to build pressure and organizing locally around things like divestment.
If activists are interested in finding out more, I know that Little Sis has a database of connections among people prominent in business and government and so on, and also offers trainings for people interested in learning about this kind of power mapping research or in contributing to the database. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. So as an organization, we're, you know, consider ourselves a watchdog research group focused on money and politics and also the networks of wealthy individuals, powerful organizations that are shaping kind of policy in the US. So we have three main buckets of work that we do. We produce independent research that we publish in the form of reports and articles on our news site, Eyes on the Ties. Often we publish research in partnership with various movement organizations to support their campaigns. Then we also do, as you mentioned, a lot of behind the scenes work, building capacity in organizations through training. And then we have a public training series this year that we launched called Research Tools for Organizers, which happens the third Thursday of every month and is really a way for us to help boost research skills and analysis across different social movement ecosystems that we don't work directly with in partnership, but can just help to start nurture. And then finally, as you mentioned, also we develop technology for activists, organizers, researchers, campaigners to use to build out their power research, to give it a home, and to, you know, help people sort of not have to start from scratch when they're doing kind of research on things like big financial institutions, right? So if you're interested in a transnational global bank like Citibank, you can come to the Little Sis database and learn a little bit through the research that other activists have done to get a little bit of a kind of bearing on what Citibank does and is. And so we have littlesis.org database. And then we also have a mapping tool called Olographer, which is a way to take the research that's in the Little Sis database and turn it into a visual kind of story that you can share. And, you know, we think that power research kind of helps us gain more of an accurate picture of who we're up against and what those people care about. And power research can kind of help us demystify the corporate playbook and understand a bit better how they think and the networks and connections that they rely on to maintain their power so that we can really wage a good fight, you know, a well-informed fight.
Is there anything else that you would like people to know about this project or about Little Sis and its work?
Again, to just kind of plug the Research Tools for Organizers training series, which has been really popular and successful. And we've been really excited to see how many people who are just kind of starting on the work of campaigning and organizing locally are finding it helpful to learn new research skills, but I think also in many ways, just like connect and see that there's others working on these similar issues kind of across the country. So I think it's been a way to actually, during this time, I think during this past year when things have been really bleak and hard, to see that there are so many people who are being mobilized and galvanized in this moment to learn new skills and to apply those to the work of, you know, collective liberation and holding corporations accountable. So yeah, just put another plug in for that research training series.
Well, thank you so much, Munira Lokhandwala. for talking with us today about the Genocide Gentry and Little Sis and the work you're doing. Thank
Thanks
you.
so much, Fran. It was great to chat with you.